Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. Today we're going to do some Saki. Done a few stories of his in the first section of the collected works that I have. Hector Humunro is the real name of Saki, M-U-N-R-O. Today we're going to start with Reginald in Russia and just do some of his little set pieces in there. So, picking up on page... Let's see... And I should say that we had done up through 29, Reginald in Russia. These were first collected in 1910. So the height of the British Empire right before World War I. Reginald in Russia. Reginald sat in a corner of the princess's salon and tried to forgive the furniture, which started out with an obvious intention of being Louis Keynes, but relapsed at frequent intervals into Wilhelm II. He classified the princess with that distinct type of woman that looks as if it habitually went out to feed hens in the rain. Her name was Olga. She kept what she hoped and believed to be a fox terrier and professed what she thought were socialist opinions. It is not necessary to be called Olga if you are a Russian princess. In fact, Reginald knew quite a number who were called Vera. But the fox terrier and the socialism are essential. The Countess Lomshin keeps a bulldog, said the princess suddenly. In England it is more chic to have a bulldog than a... Is it more chic to have a bulldog than a fox terrier? Reginald threw back his mind over the canine fashions of the last 10 years and gave an evasive answer. Do you think her handsome, the Countess Lomshin? Asked the princess. Reginald thought the Countess's complexion suggested an exclusive diet of macaroons and pale sherry. He said so. But that cannot be possible, said the Princess, triumphantly. I've seen her eating fish soup at Donon's. The Princess always defended a friend's complexion, if it was really bad. With her, as with a great many of her sex, charity began at homeliness, and did not generally progress much further. Reginald withdrew his macaroon and sherry theory and became interested in a case of miniatures. That, said the princess, that is the old Princess Lorikoff. She lived in Millinaya Street near the Winter Palace and was one of the court ladies of the old Russian school. Her knowledge of people and events was extremely limited, but she used to patronize everyone who came in contact with her. There was a story that when she died and left in Millinaya for heaven, she addressed St. Peter in her formal staccato French, Je suis la princesse Lorikoff. Il me donne grand plaisir à faire votre connaissance. Je vous en prie me présenter au bon Dieu. St. Peter made the desired introduction, and the princess addressed le bon Dieu. Je suis la princesse Lorikoff. Il me donne grand plaisir à faire votre connaissance. On a souvent parlé de vous à l'église de la rue Million. Only the old and the clergy of established churches know how to be flippant gracefully, commented Reginald, which reminds me that in the Anglican church, in a certain foreign capital, which shall be nameless, I was present the other day when one of the junior chaplains was preaching in aid of distressed somethings or other, and he brought a really eloquent passage to a close with the remark, "The tears of the afflicted... To what shall I liken them? To diamonds?" The other junior chaplain, who had been dozing out of professional jealousy, awoke with a start and asked hurriedly, "Shall I play to diamonds, partner?" It didn't improve matters when the senior chaplain remarked dreamily, but with painful distinctness, "Double diamonds." Everyone looked at the preacher, half expecting him to redouble, but he contented himself with scoring what points he could under the circumstances. "You English are always so frivolous," said the princess. "In Russia, we have too many troubles to permit our being light-hearted." Reginald gave a delicate shiver, such as an Italian greyhound might give in contemplating the approach of an ice age of which he personally disapproved, and resigned himself to the inevitable political discussion. "Nothing that you hear about us in England is true," was the princess's hopeful beginning. "I always refused to learn Russian geography at school," observed Reginald. "I was certain some of the names must be wrong." Everything is wrong with our system of government, continued the princess placidly. The bureaucrats think only of their pockets, and the people are exploited and plundered in every direction, and everything is mismanaged. With us, said Reginald, a cabinet usually gets the credit of being depraved and worthless beyond the bounds of human conception by the time it has been in office about 4 years. But if it is a bad government, you can turn it out at the election, argued the princess. As far as I remember, we generally do, said Reginald. But here it is dreadful. Everyone goes to such extremes. In England, you never go to extremes. We go to the Albert Hall, explained Reginald. There is always a seesaw with us between repression and violence, continued the princess, and the pity of it is the people are really not in the least inclined to be anything but peaceable. Nowhere will you find people more good-natured or family circles where there is more affection. There, I agree with you, said Reginald. I know a boy who lives somewhere in the French Quai who is a case in point. His hair curls naturally, especially on Sundays, and he plays bridge well, even for a Russian, which is saying much. I don't think he has any other accomplishments, but his family affection is really of a very high order. When his maternal grandmother died, he didn't go as far as to give up bridge altogether, but he declared on nothing but black suits for the next 3 months. That, I think, was really beautiful. The princess was not impressed. I think you must be a very self-indulgent and live only for amusement, she said. A life of pleasure-seeking and card-playing and dissipation brings only dissatisfaction. You will find that out some day. Oh, I know it turns out that way sometimes, assented Reginald. Forbidden fizz is often the sweetest. But the remark was wasted on the princess, who preferred champagne that had at least a suggestion of dissolved barley sugar. I hope you will come and see me again, she said in a tone that prevented the hope from becoming too infectious, adding as a happy afterthought, you must come to stay with us in the country. Her particular part of the country was a few hundred versts the other side of Tamboff, with some 15 miles of agrarian disturbance between her and the nearest neighbor. Reginald felt that there is some privacy which should be sacred from intrusion. That was Reginald in Russia. And now the reticence of Lady Anne. Egbert came into the large, dimly lit drawing-room with an air of a man who is not certain whether he is entering a dovecote or a bomb factory, and is prepared for either eventuality. The little domestic quarrel over the luncheon table had not been fought to a definite finish, and the question was how far Lady Anne was in a mood to renew or forego hostilities. Her pose in the armchair by the tea-table was rather elaborately rigid. In the gloom of a December afternoon, Egbert's pince-nez did not materially help him to discern the expression of her face. By way of breaking whatever ice might be floating on the surface, he made a remark about a dim religious light. He or Lady Anne were accustomed to make that remark between 4:30 and 6 on winter and late autumn evenings. It was a part of their married life. There was no recognized rejoinder to it, and Lady Anne made none. Don Tarquinio lay astretch on the Persian rug, basking in the firelight with superb indifference to the possible ill-humor of Lady Anne. His pedigree was as flawlessly Persian as the rug, and his ruff was coming into the glory of its second winter. The page-boy, who had Renaissance tendencies, had christened him Don Tarquinio. Left to themselves, Egbert and Lady Anne would unfailingly have called him Fluff, but they were not obstinate. Egbert poured himself out some tea. As the silence gave no sign of breaking on Lady Anne's initiative, he braced himself for another Yermak effort. "My remark at lunch had a purely academic application," he announced. "You seem to put an unnecessarily personal significance into it." Lady Anne maintained her defensive barrier of silence. The bullfinch lazily filled in the interval with an air from Iphigenie and Tauride. Egbert recognized it immediately because it was the only air the bullfinch whistled, and he had come to them with a reputation for whistling it. Both Egbert and Lady Anne would have preferred something from The Yeoman of the Guard, which was their favorite opera. In matters artistic, they had a similarity of taste. They leaned toward the honest and explicit in art. A picture, for instance, that told its own story, with generous assistance from the title. A riderless war horse, with harness in obvious disarray, staggering into a courtyard full of pale, swooning women and marginally noted bad news, suggested to their minds a distinct interpretation of some military. They could see what it was meant to convey and explain it to friends of duller intelligence. The silence continued. As a rule, Lady Anne's displeasure became articulate and markedly voluble after 4 minutes of introductory muteness. Egbert seized the milk jug and poured some of its contents into Don Tarquinio's saucer. As the saucer was already full to the brim, an unsightly overflow was the result. Don Tarquinio looked on with a surprised interest that evanesced into elaborate unconsciousness when he was appealed to by Egbert to come and drink up some of the spilt matter. Don Tarquinio was prepared to play many roles in life, but a vacuum carpet cleaner was not one of them. "Don't you think we're being rather foolish?" said Egbert cheerfully. If Lady Anne thought so, she didn't say so. "I dare say the fault has been partly on my side," continued Egbert with evaporating cheerfulness. "After all, I'm only human, you know. You seem to forget that I'm only human." He insisted on the point as if there had been unfounded suggestions that he was built on satyr lines, with goat continuation where the human left off. The bullfinch recommenced its air from Iphigenie and Tauride. Egbert began to feel depressed. Lady Anne was not drinking her tea. Perhaps she was feeling unwell. But when Lady Anne felt unwell, she was not wont to be reticent on the subject. "No one knows what I suffer from indigestion," was one of her favorite statements. But the lack of knowledge could only have been caused by defective listening. The amount of information available on the subject would have supplied material for a monograph. Evidently, Lady Anne was not feeling unwell. Egbert began to think he was being unreasonably dealt with. Naturally, he began to make concessions. "I dare say," he observed, taking as a central position on the hearth rug as Don Tarquinio could be persuaded to concede him, "I may have been to blame. I am willing, if I can restore things to a happier standpoint, to undertake to lead a better life." He wondered vaguely how it would be possible. Temptations came to him in middle age, tentatively and without insistence, like a neglected butcher boy who asked for a Christmas box in February for no more hopeful reason than that he didn't get one in December. He had no more idea of succumbing to them than he had of purchasing the fish knives and fur boas that ladies are impelled to sacrifice through the medium of advertisement columns during 12 months of the year. Still, there was something impressive in this unasked-for renunciation of possibly latent enormities. Lady Anne showed no sign of being impressed. Egbert looked at her nervously through his glasses. To get the worst of an argument with her was no new experience. To get the worst of a monologue was a humiliating novelty. "I shall go and dress for dinner," he announced, in a voice into which he intended some shade of sternness to creep. At the door, a final access of weakness impelled him to make a further appeal. "Aren't we being very silly?" "A fool," was Don Tarquinio's mental comment as the door closed on Egbert's retreat. Then he lifted his velvet forepaws in the air and leapt lightly onto a bookshelf immediately under the bullfinch's cage. It was the first time he had seemed to notice the bird's existence, but he was carrying out a long-form theory of action with the precision of mature deliberation. The bullfinch, who had fancied himself something of a despot, depressed himself of a sudden into a third of his normal displacement. Then he fell to a helpless wing-beating and shrill cheeping. He had cost 27 shillings without the cage, but Lady Anne made no sign of interfering. She had been dead for 2 hours. So that has its effect, but I also noticed the deference to the woman, even deference to the cat, and how this led eventually in political directions. I won't go into here because we're dealing with literature, but still you notice it. Now we'll do another one. The Lost Sanjak, S-A-N-J-A-K. Again, this is Reginald in Russia, is this portion of the collection. The prison chaplain entered the condemned cell for the last time to give such consolation as he might. "The only consolation I crave for," said the condemned, "is to tell my story in its entirety to someone who will at least give it a respectful hearing." "We must not be too long over it," said the chaplain, looking at his watch. The condemned repressed a shiver and commenced. "Most people will be of the opinion that I am paying the penalty of my own violent deeds. In reality, I am a victim to a lack of specialization in my education and character."
"Lack of specialization," said the chaplain.
"Yes. If I had been known as one of the few men in England familiar with the fauna of the Outer Hebrides," those are islands around UK, "or able to repeat stanzas of Camoens' poetry in the original, I should have had no difficulty in proving my identity in the crisis when my identity became a matter of life and death for me. But my education was merely a moderately good one, and my temperament was of the general order that avoids specialization. I know a little in a general way about gardening and history and old masters, but I could never tell you offhand whether Stella Vanderlupin was a chrysanthemum, or a heroine of the American War of Independence, or something by Romney in the Louvre." The chaplain shifted uneasily in his seat. Now that the alternatives had been suggested, they all seemed dreadfully possible. "I fell in love, or thought I did, with the local doctor's wife," continued the condemned. "Why I should have done so, I cannot say, for I do not remember that she possessed any particular attractions of mind or body. On looking back at past events, it seems to me that she must have been a distinctly ordinary, but I suppose the doctor had fallen in love with her once, and what man has done, man can do. She appeared to be pleased with the attentions which I paid her, and to the extent that I suppose I might, and to that extent, I suppose, I might say that she encouraged me, but I think she was honestly unaware that I meant anything more than a little neighborly interest. When one is face to face with death, one wishes to be just." The chaplain murmured approval. "At any rate, she was genuinely horrified when I took advantage of the doctor's absence one evening to declare what I believed to be my passion. She begged me to pass out of her life, and I could scarcely do otherwise than agree, though I hadn't the dimmest idea of how it was to be done. In novels and plays, I knew it was a regular occurrence, and if you mistook a lady's sentiments or intentions, you went off to India and did things on the frontier as a matter of course. As I stumbled along the doctor's carriage drive, I had no very clear idea as to what my line of action was to be, but I had a vague feeling that I must look at the Times Atlas before going to bed. Then, on the dark and lonely highway, I came suddenly on a dead body." The chaplain's interest in the story visibly quickened. "Judging by the clothes it wore, the corpse was that of a Salvation Army captain. Some shocking accident seems to have struck him down, and the head was crushed and battered out of all human semblance. Probably, I thought, a motor car fatality. And then, with a sudden overmastering insistence, came another thought, that here was a remarkable opportunity for losing my identity and passing out of the life of the doctor's wife forever. No tiresome and risky voyage to distant lands, but a mere exchange of clothes and identity with the unknown victim of an unwitnessed accident. With considerable difficulty, I undressed the corpse and clothed it anew in my own garments. As anyone who has valeted a dead Salvation Army captain in an uncertain light will appreciate, the difficulty. With the idea, presumably, of inducing the doctor's wife to leave her husband's roof tree for some habitation which would be run at my expense, I had crammed my pockets with a store of banknotes, which represented a good deal of my immediate worldly wealth. When, therefore, I stole away into the world in the guise of a nameless Salvationist, I was not without resources which would easily support so humble a role for a considerable period. I tramped to a neighboring market town, and, late as the hour was, the production of a few shillings procured me supper and a night's lodging in a cheap coffee house. The next day I started forth on an aimless course of wandering from one small town to another. I was already somewhat disgusted with the upshot of my sudden freak. In a few hours' time, I was considerably more so. In the contents bill of a local news sheet, I read the announcement of my own murder at the hands of some person unknown. On buying a copy of that paper for a detailed account of the tragedy, which at first had aroused in me a certain grim amusement,
I found that the deed was ascribed to a wandering Salvationist of doubtful antecedents who had been seen lurking in the roadway near the scene of the crime. I was no longer amused. The matter promised to be embarrassing. What I had mistaken for a motor accident was evidently a case of savage assault and murder, and, until the real culprit was found, I should have much difficulty in explaining my intrusion into the affair. Of course, I could establish my own identity, but how, without disagreeably involving the doctor's wife, could I give any adequate reason for changing clothes with a murdered man? While my brain worked feverishly at this problem, I subconsciously obeyed a secondary instinct to get as far away as possible from the scene of the crime. And to get rid, at all costs, of my incriminating uniform. There I found a difficulty. I tried two or three obscure clothes shops, but my entrance invariably aroused an attitude of hostile suspicion in the proprietors, and on one excuse or another they avoided serving me with a now ardently desired change of clothing. The uniform that I had so thoughtlessly donned seemed as difficult to get out of as the fatal shirt of, you know, I forget the creature's name. Yes, yes, the chaplain said hurriedly, go on with your story. Somehow, until I could get out of those compromising garments, I felt I would not be safe to surrender myself to the police. The thing that puzzled me was why no attempt was made to arrest me, since there was no question as to the suspicion which followed me, like an inseparable shadow, wherever I went. Stares, nudgings, whisperings, and even loud-spoken remarks of "Latium" greeted my every appearance, and the meanest and most deserted eating house that I patronized soon became filled with a crowd of furtively watching customers. I began to sympathize with the feelings of royal personages trying to do a little private shopping under the unsparing scrutiny of an irrepressible public. And still, with all this inarticulate shadowing which weighed on my nerves almost worse than open hostility would have done, no attempt was made to interfere with my liberty. Later on, I discovered the reason. At the time of the murder on the lonely highway, a series of important bloodhound trials had been taking place in the near neighborhood, and some dozen and a half couples of trained animals had been put on the track of the supposed murderer. On my track. One of our most public-spirited London dailies had offered a princely prize to the owner of the pair that should first track me down, and betting on the chances of the respective competitors became rife throughout the land. The dogs ranged far and wide over about 13 counties, and though my own movements had become by this time perfectly well known to police and public alike, the sporting instincts of the nation stepped in to prevent my premature arrest. Give the dogs a chance, was the prevailing sentiment, whenever some ambitious local constable wished to put an end to my drawn-out evasion of justice. My final capture by the winning pair was not a very dramatic episode. In fact, I'm not sure they would have taken any notice of me if I hadn't spoken to them and patted them, but the event gave rise to an extraordinary amount of partisan excitement. The owner of the pair who were the next nearest up at the finish was an American, and he lodged a protest on the ground that an otterhound had married into the family of the winning pair 6 generations ago, and that the prize had been offered to the first pair of bloodhounds to capture the murderer, and that a dog that had 1/64th part of otterhound blood in it couldn't technically be considered a bloodhound. I forget how the matter was ultimately settled, but it aroused a tremendous amount of acrimonious discussion on both sides of the Atlantic. My own contribution to the controversy consisted in pointing out that the whole dispute was beside the mark, as the actual murderer had not yet been captured. But I soon discovered that on this point there was not the least divergence of public or expert opinion. I had looked forward apprehensively to the proving of my identity and the establishment of my motives as a disagreeable necessity. I speedily found out that the most disagreeable part of the business was that it couldn't be done. When I saw in the glass the haggard and hunted expression which the experiences of the past few weeks had stamped on my erstwhile placid countenance, I could scarcely feel surprised that the few friends and relations I possessed refused to recognize me in my altered guise, and persisted in their obstinate but widely shared belief that it was I who had been done to death on the highway. To make matters worse, infinitely worse, an aunt of the really murdered man, an appalling female of an obviously low order of intelligence, identified me as her nephew, and gave the authorities a lurid account of my depraved youth and of her laudable but unavailing efforts to spank me into a better way. I believe it was even proposed to search me for fingerprints.
But, said the chaplain, surely your educational attainments.
That was just the crucial point, said the condemned. That was where my lack of specialization told so fatally against me. The dead Salvationist, whose identity I had so lightly and so disastrously adopted, had possessed a veneer of cheap modern education. It should have been easy to demonstrate that my learning was altogether on a different plane to his, but in my nervousness I bungled miserably over test after test that was put to me. The little French I had ever known deserted me. I could not render a simple phrase about the gooseberry of the gardener into that language because I had forgotten the French for gooseberry.
The chaplain again wriggled uneasily in his seat.
And then, resumed the condemned, came the final discomfiture. In our village we had a modest little debating club, and I remember having promised, chiefly, I suppose, to please and impress the doctor's wife, to give a sketchy kind of a lecture on the Balkan crisis. I had relied on being able to get my facts from one or two standard works and the back numbers of certain periodicals. The prosecution had made a careful note of the circumstance that the man whom I claimed to be, and actually was, had posed locally as some sort of second-hand authority on Balkan affairs, and, in the midst of a string of questions on indifferent topics, the examining counsel asked me with a diabolical suddenness if I could tell the court the whereabouts of Novibizar. I felt the question to be a crucial one. Something told me that the answer was St. Petersburg or Baker Street. I hesitated, looked helplessly round the sea of tensely expectant faces, pulled myself together, and chose Baker Street, and then I knew that everything was lost. The prosecution had no difficulty in demonstrating that an individual, even moderately versed in the affairs of the near fast, could never have so unceremoniously dislocated Novibizar from its accustomed corner of the map. It was an answer which the Salvation Army captain might conceivably have made, and I had made it. The circumstantial evidence connecting the Salvationist with a crime was overwhelmingly convincing, and I had inextricably identified myself with the Salvationist. And thus it comes to pass that in 10 minutes' time I shall be hanged by the neck until I am dead, in expiation of the murder of myself, which murder never took place, and of which, in any case, I am necessarily innocent. When the chaplain returned to his quarter some 15 minutes later, the black flag was floating over the prison's tower. Breakfast was waiting for him in the dining room, but he first passed into his library and, taking up the Times Atlas, consulted a map of the Balkan Peninsula. A thing like that, he observed, closing the volume with a snap, might happen to anyone. Next up, the sex that doesn't shop. The sex that doesn't shop. The opening of a large new center for West End shopping, particularly feminine shopping, suggests the reflection, do women ever really shop? Of course, it is a well-attested fact that they go forth shopping as assiduously as a bee goes flower visiting. But do they shop in the practical sense of the word? Granted, the money, time, and energy, a resolute course of shopping on transactions would naturally result in having one's ordinary domestic needs unfailingly supplied. Whereas it is notorious that women servants and housewives of all classes make it almost a point of honor not to be supplied with everyday necessities. We shall be out of starch by Thursday, they say with fatalistic foreboding. And by Thursday they are out of starch. They have predicted almost to a minute when their moment of their supply would give out. And if Thursday happens to be early closing day, their triumph is complete. A shop where starch is stored for retail purposes possibly stands at their very door, but the feminine mind has rejected such an obvious source for replenishing a dwindling stock. We don't deal there, places it at once beyond the pale of human resort. And it is noteworthy that just as a sheep-worrying dog seldom molests the flocks in his near neighborhood, so a woman rarely deals with shops in her immediate vicinity. The more remote the source of supply, the more fixed seems to be the resolve to run short of the commodity. The Ark had probably not quitted its last moorings 5 minutes before some feminine voice gloatingly recorded a shortage of birdseed. A few days ago, two lady acquaintances of mine were confessing to some mental uneasiness because a friend had just called before lunchtime, and they had been unable to ask her to stop and share their meal, as, with a touch of legitimate pride, there was nothing in the house. I pointed out that they lived in a street that bristled with provision shops and that it would have been easy to mobilize a very passable luncheon in less than 5 minutes. That, they said with quiet dignity, would not have occurred to us. And I felt that I had suggested something bordering on the indecent. But it is in catering for her literary wants that a woman's shopping capacity breaks down most completely. If you have perchance produced a book which is met with some little measure of success, you are certain to get a letter from some lady whom you scarcely know to bow to, asking you how it can be got. She knows the name of the book, its author, and who published it, but how to get into actual contact with it is still an unsolved problem to her. You write back pointing out that to have recourse to an ironmonger or a corn dealer will only entail delay and disappointment, and suggest an application to a bookseller as the most hopeful thing you can think of. In a day or two, she writes again, "It is all right. I have borrowed it from your aunt." Here, of course, we have an example of the beyond shopper, one who has learned the better way. But the helplessness exists even when such bypaths of relief are closed. A lady who lives in the West End was expressing to me the other day her interest in West Highland Terriers and her desire to know more about the breed. So, when, a few days later, I came across an exhaustive article on that subject in the current number of one of our better-known outdoor weeklies, I mentioned the circumstance in a letter, giving the date of that number. "I cannot get the paper," was her telephone response. And she couldn't. She lived in a city where news agents are numbered, I suppose, by the thousand, and she must have passed dozens of such shops in her daily shopping excursions. But as far as she was concerned, that article on West Highland Terriers might as well have been written in a missal stored away in some Buddhist monastery in eastern Tibet. The brutal directness of the masculine shopper arouses a certain combative derision in the feminine onlooker. A cat that spreads one shrew mouse over the greater part of a long summer afternoon, and then possibly loses him, doubtless feels the same contempt for the terrier who compresses his rat into 10 seconds of the strenuous life. I was finishing off a short list of purchases a few afternoons ago when I was discovered by a lady of my acquaintance whom, swerving aside from the lead given us by her godparents 30 years ago, we will call Agatha. "You're surely not buying blotting paper here," she exclaimed in an agitated whisper, and she seemed so genuinely concerned that I stayed my hand. "Let me take you to the Winks and Pinks," she said, as soon as we were out of the building. "They've got such lovely shades of blotting paper. Pearl and heliotrope and momi and crushed, but I want ordinary white blotting paper," I said. "Never mind, they know me at Winks and Pinks," she replied inconsequently. Agatha apparently has an idea that blotting paper is only sold in small quantities to persons of known reputation and who may be trusted not to put it into dangerous or improper uses. After walking some 200 yards, she began to feel that her tea was of more importance than my blotting paper. "What do you want blotting paper for?" she asked suddenly. I explained patiently. "I use it to dry up the ink of wet manuscript without smudging the writing. Probably a Chinese invention of the 2nd century before Christ, but I'm not sure. The only other use for it that I can think of is to roll it into a ball for a kitten to play with." "But you haven't got a kitten," said Agatha, with a feminine desire for stating the entire truth on most occasions. "A stray one might come in at any moment," I replied. Anyway, I didn't get the blotting paper. So that on the sex that doesn't shop, on the difference between men and women in shopping. And finally, we'll close it out with the blood feud of Toad Water, a West Country epic. The Blood Feud of Toadwater, a West Country epic. The Cricks lived at Toadwater, and in the same lonely upland spot, Fate had pitched the home of the Sanderses. And for miles around these two dwellings, there was never a neighbor or a chimney or even a burying ground to bring a sense of cheerful communion or social intercourse. Nothing but fields and spinneys and barns and lanes and wastelands. Such was Toadwater, and even so, Toadwater had its history. Thrust away in the benighted hinterland of a scattered market district, it might have been supposed that these two detached items of the great human family would have leaned toward one another in fellowship, a fellowship begotten of kindred circumstances and a common isolation from the outer world. And perhaps it had been once so, but the way of things had brought it otherwise. Indeed, otherwise. Fate, which had linked the two families in such unavoidable association of habitat, had ordained that the Crick household should nourish and maintain among its earthly possessions sundry head of domestic fowls, while to the Sanderses was given a disposition toward the cultivation of garden crops. Herein lay the material, ready to hand, for the coming feud and ill blood, for the grudge between the man of herbs and the man of livestock is no new thing. You will find traces of it in the fourth chapter of Genesis. And one sunny afternoon in late spring, the feud came. Came, as such things mostly do come, with seemingly aimlessness and triviality. One of the Crick hens, in obedience to the nomadic instincts of her kind, wearied of the legitimate scratching grounds and flew over the low wall that divided the holdings of the neighbors. And there, on the yonder side, with a hurried consciousness that her time and opportunities might be limited, the misguided bird scratched and scraped and beaked and delved in the soft, yielding bed that had been prepared for the solace and well-being of a colony of seedling onions. Little showers of earth mold and root fibers went spraying before the hen and behind her, and every minute the area of her operations widened. The onions suffered considerably. Mrs. Saunders, sauntering at this luckless moment down the garden path in order to fill her soul with reproaches at the iniquity of the weeds, which grew faster than she or her good man cared to remove them, stopped in mute discomfiture before the presence of a more magnificent grievance. And then, in the hour of her calamity, she turned instinctively to the great mother, and gathered in her capacious hands large clods of the hard brown soil that lay at her feet. With a terrible sincerity of purpose, though with a contemptible inadequacy of aim, she rained her earth bolts at the marauder, and the bursting pellets called forth a flood of cackling protest and panic from the hastily departing fowl. Calmness under misfortune is not an attribute of either henfolk or womenkind, and while Mrs. Saunders declaimed over her onion bed such portions of the slang dictionary as are permitted by the nonconformist conscience to be said or sung, the Vasco da Gama fowl was waking the echoes of Toadwater with crescendo bursts of throat music which compelled attention to her griefs. Mrs. Crick had a long family, and was therefore licensed in the eyes of the world to have a short temper, and when some of her ubiquitous offspring had informed her, with the authority of eyewitnesses, that her neighbor had so far forgotten herself as to heave stones at her hen, her best hen, the best layer in the countryside, her thoughts clothed themselves in language unbecoming to a Christian woman. So at least said Mrs. Saunders, to whom most of the language was applied. Nor was she, on her part, surprised at Mrs. Crick's conduct in letting her stray hen stray into other bodies' gardens, and then abusing of them, seeing as how she remembered things against Mrs. Crick, and the latter simultaneously had recollections of lurking episodes in the past of Susan Saunders that were nothing to her credit. Fond memory, when all things fade, we fly to thee. And in the paling light of an April afternoon, the two women confronted each other from their respective sides of the party wall, recalling with shuddering breath the blots and blemishes of their neighbor's family record. There was that aunt of Mrs. Crick's who had died a pauper in an Exeter workhouse. Everyone knew that Mrs. Saunders' uncle on her mother's side drank himself to death. Then there was that Bristol cousin of Mrs. Crick's. From the shrill triumph with which his name was dragged in, his crime must have been pilfering from a cathedral, at least. But as both remembrances were speaking at once, it was difficult to distinguish his infamy
from the scandal which beclouded the memory of Mrs. Saunders' brother's wife's mother, who may have been a regicide, and was certainly not a rice person as Mrs. Crick painted her. And then, with an air of accumulating an irresistible conviction, each belligerent informed the other that she was no lady, after which they withdrew in great silence, feeling that nothing further remained to be said. The chaffinches clinked in the apple trees, and the bees droned round the beriberis bush, and the waning sunlight slanted pleasantly across the garden plots, but between the neighbor households had sprung up a barrier of hate, permeating and permanent. The male heads of the families were necessarily drawn into the quarrel, and the children on either side were forbidden to have anything to do with the unhallowed offspring of the other party. As they had to travel a good 3 miles along the same road to school every day, this was awkward, but such things have to be. Thus, all communication between the households was sundered, except the cats. Much as Mrs. Saunders might deplore it, rumor persistently pointed to the Crick he-cat as the presumable father of sundry kittens of which the Saunders she-cat was indisputably the mother. Mrs. Saunders drowned the kittens, but the disgrace remained. Summer succeeded spring, and winter summer, but the feud outlasted the waning seasons. Once, indeed, it seemed as though the healing influences of religion might restore to Toadwater its erstwhile peace, the hostile families found themselves side by side in the soul-kindling atmosphere of a revival tea, where hymns were blended with a beverage that came of tea leaves and hot water and took after the latter parent, and where ghost... That's just funny. It tastes more like hot water than tea. And where ghostly counsel was tempered by garnishings of solidly fashioned buns, and here, wrought up by the environment of festive piety, Mrs. Saunders so far unbent as to remark guardedly to Mrs. Crick that the evening had been a fine one, Mrs. Crick, under the influence of her 9th cup of tea and her 4th hymn, ventured on the hope that it might continue fine, but a maladroit allusion on the part of the Saunders good man to the backwardness of garden crops brought the feud stalking forth from its corner with all its old bitterness. Mrs. Saunders joined heartily in the singing of the final hymn, which told of peace and joy and archangels and golden glories, but her thoughts were dwelling on the pauper aunt of Exeter. Years have rolled away, and some of the actors in this wayside drama have passed into the unknown. Other onions have arisen, have flourished, have gone their way, and the offending hen has long since expiated her misdeeds, lain with trussed feet, and look of ineffable peace under the arched roof of Barnstable Market. But the blood feud of Toadwater survives to this day. This has been Alex Linder reading you the stories of Hector Hugh Munro, the complete stories of Saki. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you with more stories from Saki real soon.